Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The summer of 1991 could prove a hot one in the wilderness of northern Quebec, with deadlines for court hearings, construction projects, and contracts being protested, negotiated, delayed, or implemented on the second phase of the hydroelectric project at James Bay. We'll visit a generating station already online and fly over the region to be flooded. Also this time, a conversation with Matthew Kuncum, Grand Chief of the Cree Council, whose homeland has already been affected by the massive changes.
It's very difficult because you haven't really lived together, or never did. You only came to a community in the summertime for convenience sake. And now you put these people all together in one town, you know, and that's very difficult. And it's cultural genocide.
These stories this time on The Environment Show. We hope you'll stay with us. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. A recent editorial in the New York Post newspaper said, "This represents an arrogant effort to interfere in the internal affairs of a friendly foreign nation." The article was reacting to political and environmental efforts in the United States to halt the construction of hydroelectric projects at James Bay in northern Canada. However, the work being proposed at James Bay has provoked Canadian and U.S. opponents to label the massive project the Amazon of the North. This vivid imagery comparing expected environmental destruction in the region with loss of tropical rainforests in Brazil along the Amazon River, one of the most publicized environmental disasters of the century, perhaps of all time. On the one hand, the provincially owned utility, Hydro-Québec, is planning one of the largest engineering feats ever undertaken to bring thousands of megawatts of water-generated electricity to millions of residents across North America. They argue, better to provide power from water than fossil fuels. On the other hand, the region to be dammed is home not only to millions of waterfowl and terrestrial animals, but to native Cree and Inuit. Political and environmental opponents of the project ask ethically, energy at what cost? In New York, the State Power Authority, charged with bringing the power from Hydro-Québec, recently sponsored a trip to the region for selected legislative aides, diplomats, environmentalists, and journalists. Don Matheson of member station WNYC visited one of the largest generating stations on La Grande River and filed this report.
From the plane, it's clear engineers have been sculpting the earth on a large scale. The La Grande Dam No. 2 is a huge earthen structure standing over 50 stories tall. There's a mile-long spillway carved out of solid rock. And then there's the reservoir, an artificial lake stretching off into the horizon for 60 miles. A Hydro-Québec tour guide points out the structures over the aircraft public address system.
So we're slowly approaching the main dam, and the main entrance door to the underground power station, which is the
plane lands at a small airport bulldozed out of the wilderness. It has a frontier quality about it. No urban amenities, just the basics. Runway, a tower, and a small steel terminal building. A half dozen planes are on the tarmac, including two ancient DC-3s. Once on the ground, Gilles Saunier is our Hydro-Québec guide.
Beside, you see the dam. It's 2.8 kilometers long, 162 meters high. Plus, in addition to the main dam at James Bay, because the territory is very flat and because there's no mountain to contain the water, we had to fill the gaps in between the hills with different dikes.
Saunier explains that the LG2 complex is nearly 100 miles from James Bay. It's one of three completed generating facilities on the river. One additional major powerhouse will be built near the mouth of the La Grande.
The river is running at the bottom of the valley. You see parallel just at the base of the water intake structure over there. It runs from the east to the west. It's in the depression in the valley. Over there, you see the village of Radisson. The population is about 1,200 people.
Hydro-Québec built Radisson to house both the permanent workers and the temporary construction crew. Generally, both groups are kept apart. because, as Sanye explains, the construction workers can get rowdy. Company officials try to maintain a family atmosphere for the permanent employees living year-round. Construction workers live in red, tan, and cream-colored steel buildings that look like house trailers. The permanent employees live in wooden buildings. Both sections of town contain very little in the way of landscaping. The wilderness is pushed back just far enough to lay down a gravel street and put up utility poles. It's easy to imagine the glaciers left the neighborhood only 6,000 years ago.
And you have an aerial view of the main dam, and you see a little tunnel to the right of the dam. They had to leave the water of the river flow through that tunnel while they were...
This type of dam is made of rock outside, then it becomes finer and finer material inside. You have rock, you have coarse, you have gravel, you have mixed sand, you have glacial till, you know it's a mix of sand and rock. And then finally, to make it waterproof, you have compressed stone dust.
The next part of the tour was almost frightening. We descended 45 stories into bedrock to reach the powerhouse. It's the largest underground structure of its type in the world, a 1,500-foot chamber blasted out of Canadian Shield. It contains six gigantic turbine generators, which are powered by rushing water. The turbines are driven at lightning speed. Enough electricity is produced at LG2 to run a city with 4 million people. Everything in the powerhouse seems built on a superhuman scale.
What you see to your right is the LG2 reservoir. As we were flying up, you noticed that there were more and more water spaces. 40% of the area was covered with water before we created the reservoir.
The terrain is harsh. Ice covers much of the land from November through May. Rivers and lakes abound, covering about 15% of the Earth's surface. The soil is thin and rocky, supporting only a sparse population of fir trees. The forests are scattered and consist of black spruce and jack pine. 100-year-old trees grow only about 12 feet tall. They are not suitable for lumbering. On the return flight, Serge Dubé, Hydro-Québec's expert on native peoples, discusses their lifestyle and how development has impacted them. Dubé says fewer than 20,000 indigenous people live in a vast area stretching across the frozen north.
The Crees are around 11,000, while the Inuits are somewhere around 7,000 people living on a territory that is some 410,000 square miles. It would be nearly as large as, I'd say, California and Texas put together.
According to Dubé, the Cree are generally opposed to any new projects, while the Inuits do not object to expansion of hydro development. The utility wants to begin construction of a vast new project on the Great Whale River in the coming year. According to Dubé, the Inuits are people of the sea. Europeans used to call them Eskimos. Their traditional way of life consists of fishing on the Hudson and James Bays. The Cree, on the other hand, are Indians. They are inland hunters, trappers, and fishermen.
Out of the 11,000 Crees, there's still about 4,000 that have their traditional activities as a way of life. The other Crees do participate in of geese hunting or moose hunting in fall or spring, but they're more occasional hunters than the traditional way of life, which was going out on the land for 8 months during winter.
Dubé says most of the Crees and Inuits use tools of modern society. He notes since 1975, the native peoples have adapted many modern conveniences.
And every community is electrified. It has television. They have modern housing. Most of the communities, there's no... all the houses have been renewed in the last 15 years.
But on the other hand, Dubé notes the native peoples also want to retain the option of leading their traditional way of life. They are working to keep their own distinct culture and institutions. I'm Don Matheson reporting.
Don Matheson reports from member station WNYC in New York. This was the first of a two-part series prepared for the Environment Show. More in a moment. Canada's provincially owned utility, Hydro-Québec, is planning a multi-stage hydro project at James Bay. Phase 1 was completed in 1985. Phase 2 was projected to go online in 2001. The combination of Phase 1 and Phase 2 would produce 27,000 megawatts of hydropower, dwarfing any other such project in the world. To create the water force, an area the size of France would be flooded, in turn affecting a watershed equal to the area east of the Mississippi River in the United States. Though some of the power generated would be kept in Quebec, thousands of megawatts would be sold to the United States. Under terms of multi-billion dollar contracts already signed, new electricity is scheduled to start flowing across the border in 1995, even before Phase 2 would be complete. Government energy officials who signed the agreement say the power will be reliable, cheap, clean, and stimulate the economy. Opponents say, through energy conservation, we could save more energy than we would be purchasing. In addition, the billions of dollars sent out of the country better could be spent here to provide jobs. In part two of a series prepared from a recent fact-finding trip to Canada, Don Matheson of member station WNYC spoke with several officials involved, including Pierre Bolduc, vice president of Hydro-Québec.
I think we're talking about a $5 to $8 billion revenue over the life of the of that contract, which the New York Power Authority has stated would save in New York hundreds of millions of dollars as opposed to what they would be paying if they were buying that for developing themselves new generation or if they were buying from other suppliers.
This hydropower contract we have will save $3 billion over the next 20 years.
Vincent Tobin is a New York Power Authority vice president.
In addition to that, that's money, for example, for New York City. New York City government will save about $1 billion, and that's money New York City government can use for other programs. And the savings in dollars become very important.
We've tended to focus on trying to evenly divide the benefits of this deal. And we, if everyone's assumptions are confirmed, we'll probably be making equal amounts of profits on both sides of the border. And in both cases, hopefully, this will lead to benefits to our own customers, less rapid rate increases and benefits, as well as economic benefits to the province here.
The New York Power Authority has been doing business with Hydro-Québec since 1974. New contracts call for vast electricity purchases, 1 million kilowatts on a year-round basis starting in 1995. The authority's Vincent Tobin says it's important for New York to diversify its sources of electricity.
One of the reasons that we look to hydropower from Quebec is that southeastern New York and New York City and Long Island is about the most oil-dependent area of the country right now for electricity generation. We think it's important to diversify our sources of electricity, and hydropower, which is probably the cleanest source of electricity production, is the best way to do that.
Tobin claims hydropower imports will allow utilities in New York State to close older, inefficient, polluting plants.
It's important, I think, to recognize that any choice you make in the energy area has impacts. If you choose not to buy hydropower from Canada, then you're making a choice to keep burning fossil fuels. What we believe is that on balance, it's better to shut some of those plants down or defer using them and go to hydropower.
Some environmentalists in New York and New England are arguing that American utilities should cancel their contracts with the Canadians because the hydro projects don't meet environmental standards. Tobin rejects that logic.
The Canadian process does give everybody a fair shake and does give the environment a fair shake. In fact, the only real independent study that's been done of the issue was done by the Harvard Energy School about 2 years ago. And they found that the Canadian environmental licensing process for power plants was stricter in Canada than it was in the United States.
The new Quebec-New York power contracts are not yet a done deal. Either side can bow out without penalty between now and November. Hydro-Québec spokesman Michelle Hanoir says there are strings attached to the Canadian federal government's backing.
The National Energy Board approved the contract, but put a condition on the contract, on the license, that all generation, which would be used for the contract, need to go and undergo all federal environmental review or process and standards. And this might raise future problems.
Power authority officials in New York are confident the contract will be consummated.
The environmentalists have, or the opposition, I should say, has introduced legislation in Albany. It's never passed either house. It's never gotten a sponsor in the Senate, and it is, and it's just never gone anywhere.
A spokesman for the Cree Indians, Matthew Mocrash, hopes American Utilities cancel contracts with Hydro-Québec.
I think the reason why they signed it for, to begin with was because they were not informed of the dangers that it poses. Because this project like this also emits carbon dioxide and methane gas because of the rotting vegetation. It contributes to global warming. I mean, that's an international issue. Even the waters, the contaminants that get out of the reservoir, they've been traced as far as Georgia's banks, you know, in the Atlantic Ocean.
Mocrash says his people live in fear of the dams breaking and flooding native villages. Cree leaders have been traveling widely, speaking out against new James Bay developments, particularly the Great Whale River Project, the next major development slated for construction in the region. I'm Don Matheson reporting.
Don Matheson reports from member station WNYC in New York, and his recent trip to the Hydro-Québec facilities was sponsored by the New York Power Authority. If you look on a map or fly over the region, at the southern stretch of the Hudson Bay, scanning east of James Bay, you will see thousands of square miles of wilderness cut only by great rivers and lakes. By the first quarter of next century, however, most of this region is scheduled to be underwater, the result of a massive river diversion and damming project formulated by the provincial utility Hydro-Québec, from a project Premier Robert Bourassa has described as the project of the century. From the air or on paper, the region looks empty and well able to withstand such trauma. However, the region is teeming with life. Thousands of migratory birds, fish, and land animals, including vast herds of caribou, make their home along the rivers and in the forests. Equally important, the territory is home and hunting ground for thousands of native Cree and Inuit who have lived in this subarctic region for thousands of years. The first phase of this work has already been completed and is already causing measurable damage. The native people not only oppose continuing the hydro project, they fear it. Matthew Kuncum, Grand Chief of the Cree Council, says it literally is a matter of life and death for the land and for the people.
We feel that that Hydro-Québec had lied to us, that Hydro-Québec told us that there'll be minimum environmental damages. We will control and introduce remedial mitigation works programs, try to minimize the impacts. Well, all that's a lie. We know the impacts. We're the people of the land. What Bourassa called the project of the century is right in our own backyards. We know from the behavior of the animals, from looking at the sun and the clouds, that there's drastic climatic changes because we can't predict by looking at nature and the behavior of the animals of the weather. We know what to expect. And now we can't do that. It's very difficult for a trapper who depends on the weather and who depends on the animals. So when you affect the small and big game, you in essence drive the people off the land. And therefore, for us, what we know about the project is that it has destroyed the spawning grounds of the fish. It has poisoned the rivers that are supposed to provide life. And has poisoned the waters, and thereby the mercury is coming out from those dams. It wasn't there before. And we're prevented to eat any fish, which is one of our main diets. And we know the nesting grounds have been affected, and the waterfowl. And we know the link between the land and the water is broken because it's all mud now because of the fluctuation of the water level in closing and opening the dam. And everything is works backwards. The rivers flow backwards. You're reshaping the geography of the land. And the animals haven't adjusted to it. We certainly haven't had time to really get used to this mega project with our own backyards. We haven't adjusted to it. We're just trying to get used to adapting to using the and living in houses. We didn't have that 15 years ago. And with television coming in, with alcohol, drugs coming in, and we're still trying to adapt to that. And then we have this large mega project where there was no environmental impact assessment that was carried out.
Kunkum is describing what changes have come to his people as a result of the influx of money, men, and machines in bringing the first phase online. The Cree and Inuit were promised and provided housing, schools, medical facilities, public works projects, and what would be considered a European white standard of living. The problem here, however, is that Cree and Inuit are neither European nor white. They are perhaps the last of the hunter-gatherers in North America.
It's cultural genocide. When you, before James Bay, when we lived in tent frames, we had no water and sewage, and we had inadequate health in each case facilities. And when it came, it was such an acceleration of building our communities. In building them like the way you build your towns, we had to have water and sewage lines. You have to have schools. You have to have a house, and you have to have a lagoon and all these facilities. And before that was when we came together. We only came together in the summertime. We're not used to living together as a group of people because out there in the land. As a trapper, you live with your grandparents if they're alive, and your immediate family, maybe one brother-in-law, four or five families, and you're hunting and covering an area maybe 40 by 60 square miles, and then you bring these people to a community. It's very difficult because you haven't really lived together. I never did. You only came to a community in the summertime for convenience sake. And now you put these people all together in one town, and that's very difficult, and it's cultural genocide, because there's a group of young people that are caught right in the middle, the young ones that did go to school because we were taken away out of school, and decided to quit school, and they only went, let's say, grade 9 or 10, and they don't know how to hunt, they don't know how to fish and trap. So they can't go back into the bush and hunt. And then you have this the same group that wants to go into the wage economy, but they can't because they only have grade 9, 10 education. So we have a group of people, and 65% of our youth are under 25 years old that are caught. And then when you flood an area and of 11,000 square kilometers of land, that trapper cannot pass that heritage which he thought that he was going to give to his son, because he took his son out of school at a young age. And I'm talking about these people that are over 30 now. And never went to school. The only life they know how is hunting, fishing, and trapping. And their father knew that skill and said, I'm going to give it to my son. And these now have children. Now what are you going to do with that group? You have displaced and relocated them. You're going right back to where we wanted to get out from, which was from government to handouts and from welfare. Now they're going to tell us, they're telling us right now, you're lazy. Drunken Indians, good for nothing, using taxpayers' money so that they can be on welfare. But meanwhile, they've destroyed the economic base that we had. And we were supporting ourselves. We were doing fine.
Matthew Kunkum, Grand Chief of the Cree Council at James Bay. Though Hydro officials have previously indicated their construction timetable was not tied to the contracts with the United States, in recent months they have said the money from the contracts is being counted on to complete the second phase. Northeast states have escape clauses in the contracts that would allow the United States to back out without financial repercussions. Environmentalists and political opposition hope that in the intervening months they can succeed in convincing U.S. officials to cancel the deal. Stay tuned for the full story on The Environment Show. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.